Members, please take your seats. We're going to start the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Today is Monday, March 5th. We do not yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started. We're going to take House File 532 up first. That is the second item on the agenda. Representative Winkler, if you'd come forward and start. This bill is going to go to the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veteran Affairs Committee. So as soon as we have a quorum, I will move the bill. So, Representative Winkler, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ryan Winkler. I represent District 44B. I don't know if it's appropriate to urge your favorable consideration prior to the motion, but I'm going to go ahead and do that anyway. House File 532 is the Minnesota Service Members Civil Relief Act, which is essentially an addition to the federal, I think it's Service and Sailor Members Civil Relief Act, which provides certain kind of contract protections to active duty military personnel who are sent overseas. The bill that we have before us in Minnesota covers essentially three things. One is a type of cold weather rule protection, which is not based on cold weather, but based on your posting in active duty overseas. The other is allows you to cancel without penalty a cell phone contract. And the third piece allows you to cancel without penalty various types of service and rental agreements, such as cable television, health club membership, travel membership, that sort of thing. And these additional protections really are aimed at some of the younger members of the, especially in Minnesota, the National Guard, who are serving overseas, because the federal act covers things like home mortgages, rent, things that are more applicable to older or more well-established family men and women who are part of the military, whereas this sort of cell phones, TV contracts, etc., I'm told by the National Guard, are issues more that the younger members are dealing with. So the central part of the bill is that if you're called to serve your country overseas, you're not asked to pay for a cell phone or a TV contract that you can't use. It's pretty straightforward. With me today is Brian Bergson of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. He was also a captain in the United States Army and served in Desert Storm, and he's just going to give a brief story about his own experience with the federal law and to show how it impacts actual service members. I guess the final point I would make is that the bill is supported by most of the industries that it affects, and for example, I know that Quest already provides this type of right to service members. So this is not something that is wholly new or revolutionary to most of the industry, but what it does is make sure that service members know they have this right, and rather than having to spend their last few days before they're posted overseas to making phone calls to try to cancel out of contracts, that sort of thing.
All right. Thank you. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Bergson. I'm the Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs for Attorney General Lori Swanson. I apologize to those of you that are on the committee that have heard this story before, because I think this is now, what, the fourth committee that this has been before?
Hope this will be four-fifths of the way through the committee process.
So if you've heard it before, it might change a little bit, but that's just because I'm getting older. I volunteered when I was in the National Guard to serve in Desert Storm and was called up got my orders on a Friday. Actually, my mother got them because they went to my home of record. I was in college at the time. My mother got them. Couldn't wait to open the envelope because she was panicking, and opened them up and just about had a heart attack when she saw that it said, you're to report to Fort Hood, Texas on Monday. And this was a Friday. And I was on my way up to National Guard drill in Hibbing at the time, and got a phone call on my cell phone, which was about this big, and had to turn around and go right back to the Twin Cities. I went immediately next Saturday morning to my landlord and showed them a copy of my orders, and they said, well, that's nice, but you can't get out of your lease. And I was really panicking, and I didn't know what to do. And so I called my unit, and the unit said, call the U.S. attorney, which at the time was Tom Heffelfinger. I called him at home, he in turn called, or one of his people called over to the apartment manager. And within a half an hour, the maintenance man, who was a veteran from Vietnam in the 1st Cav Division, of which that's the division I was going to, was over helping me pack and helping me move out of my apartment. These laws work, and all we're asking by putting this law in the statute is to help these young servicemen and women to have a little bit more peace of mind and not have to pay a cell phone bill when they're riding around in a Humvee in Iraq or Afghanistan. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if I could ask your advice, why is this bill here in front of this committee?
Representative Biskin, it was here because it also involves municipal utilities.
Yeah. All right. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it my understanding then that we should only concern ourselves with Section 1 of the bill, Madam Chair?
That is correct, Representative Biskins. I will grant members a little bit of leeway, but I would suggest that we at least limit it to the part that is before our committee. Okay. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, do you have any statement from the cooperatives and municipal utilities, et cetera, that they do not oppose this legislation?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I don't have a statement from them. They have a suggested amendment to the bill, which we plan to incorporate at the next committee hearing. But unless they're here to testify to the contrary, we've been through this several times already, and they are supportive.
Okay. Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, could you give this committee some idea of what the gist of that amendment is? If it is an amendment dealing with municipal utilities, I'd hate to have to come back here if it's substantial enough, so he could give us some inkling as to what that amendment is.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative, and actually we do have it here and we could offer it. Essentially what it does is it changes the body to which people who are aggrieved under this statute would appeal to, rather than to the Public Utilities Commission. I believe they would appeal to the appropriate governing body that governs that municipal utility.
Representative Biskins, a follow-up?
Just to you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, is this something you'd rather have done in this committee, this amendment, debated and maybe adopted in this committee?
Representative Biskins, I'm fine with, because I don't really believe that the amendment is that substantive. If they'd like to pass it out, we can do it here in this committee. If not, unless a member of the committee has an issue with it, I'm fine with it going on as well. Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to your judgment on that.
All right. Are you ready? All right. They'll pass out the amendment. Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, could you at least brief us a little bit on what's in Section 4?
Representative Winkler.
Let me just refresh my recollection of how the sections are laid out, Representative Shumper, Madam Chair.
On page 4? I'm sorry.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is, I mean, it's a simple enforcement provision. We have to have some sort of...
Section 4.
Section 4, yes. An enforcement provision. There needs to be some state entity to deal with violations of the statute as proposed, the changes in statute, and it selects the Attorney General's office to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shumper.
I think we're not communicating. Section 4, I'm wondering what the Civil Relief Act is. Are you looking at Section 5, perhaps?
Page 4, Section 4 is where, line 4.6 is where Representative Shumper was talking about. Technically, Representative Shumper, this isn't really part of the bill that is in our purview, so if you would like to talk about it or think about it while we work on this this amendment, we can do that. All right, so we do formally have a quorum. So I'll formally call this meeting to order. All right. And I move that House File 532 be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. And then I would move the A07-0144 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right. With that, Representative Winkler, any further comments?
Nothing from me, Madam Chair. Although I don't know if there was a specific, I'm still not sure what Representative Shumpert's question was. And I'd be happy to address that if there is any if that question is outstanding or if there are any additional questions from the committee.
Further questions? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Winkler. All right, next on the agenda is House File 312, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
If you could have your presenter come forward and start setting up his presentation while you speak, that would probably
sure.
be best in order to move along in time
make this
here.
As efficient as possible,
yes.
Madam Chair.
I would move that House File 312 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. With that, Representative Hornstein, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. It's great to be back in front of the Local Government Committee. I had served on this committee my first two terms and missed the action a little bit. So we'll create maybe a little for you today. Madam Chair, I would like to move a written amendment as well as an oral author's amendment. It's the DE1 amendment. And, Madam Chair, members, this is essentially the bill as it has been engrossed in the Senate. It's passed several committees, and I believe it's on general orders in the Senate, and there's some, helpful changes to the bill in terms of the salaries of Met Council members, issues related to contributions, the refund, public subsidy, et cetera. I think it makes the bill better.
All right. Well, I will move the DE1 to put the bill in the order the author wishes. Any comments or discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And quickly, Madam Chair, the oral amendment, and if I've missed something, counsel can perhaps give me an assist. I would like to move up the effective date of the for enactment from 2008 to 2010, and I believe those would be on page 16 of the DE1 amendment, lines 1614 and line 1623, strike 2008 and add 2010. And in the course of our testimony, I can talk about the rationale for that. It's really in large part to meet one of the major concerns that the Met Council has about the bill. They have others, but this is one of the major ones. And after several conversations with the Met Council, I have decided to meet them on this particular issue.
All right. Ms. Lefevre?
Madam Chairman, Representative Hornstein, I think also on the section where you changed 2008 to 2010 is the salary limitation
okay.
section. You probably would also want to do it in the effective date section, which would be page 16, line 23.
Right.
For the
yeah, I had 14 and 23, but I missed the salary. So.
Okay.
Ms. Lefevre, so what other page?
So on page 16, on line 14, change 2008 to 2010, and on page 16, line 23, change 2008 to 2010.
All right. Questions from members? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right, Representative Hornstein, please go ahead.
Thank you. Before we can go through the bill, I did want to have one of my testifiers does have to leave quickly, and I think he's probably our most important advocate. So I wanted to just introduce a former colleague of some of the people around the table in the State House, Myra Norfield, and he served in the State Senate from 2000 until 2002. So I'll just hand it over to Representative and Senator Orfield, and he'll give his presentation, and then I guess if the committee has Q&A for him specifically, we'll get that done with and then move on from there. That's okay, Madam Chair.
That's just fine. Mr. Orfield, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of an elected Metro Council. When I was a member of the House for 10 years and authored this bill many times, very frequently with then-Representative, now-Governor Pawlenty. We were co-authors of this bill, I think four times. And it was a bipartisan initiative that has been around for about 40 years. It was authored initially by Harman Ogdahl, who was a Republican, and Bill Frenzel from the western suburbs in 1967. It failed on a tie vote. The basic arguments that I have a PowerPoint presentation which we may not be able to show, but I'll provide it to the committee, and it's mostly about the budget and the authority of the Met Council. And the Metropolitan Council's budget is about $600 million. It's a very, very significant entity. It has $67 million worth of a property tax levy. It has more bonds out than all the counties combined. So it's got about $1 billion of bonds out. In general, in the United States, when we have broad, general-purpose local governments that have significant taxing powers, the American way of doing business has been to make them directly elected. It's very rare. In fact, I don't know of a precedent for a body that has this much power and this much discretionary authority to not be directly elected. There are many issues about this, and there are many concerns that cut back and forth. People might argue that electing the body might make it parochial and might make it partisan. These are dangers, certainly, to be sure, in any elected body, and any elected body particularly of this magnitude. These were also the debates that have been around in the United States since the founding, and one of the principal issues of the United States coming forward was no taxation without representation, and that bodies that have very significant discretionary powers and very significant ability to tax or levy fees need to be accountable to people. It might be less efficient, or it might create some problems. The framers talked about it as faction, people disagreeing with each other. But the general purpose in the United States and in all English-speaking governments is that when bodies are have substantial taxing and spending powers, that they should be accountable to the people. I would have shown you on the slides, if I had them, to show you the budget of the Metropolitan Council, and it would be larger than any other local governmental unit except the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County directly, if you were to think of the direct expenditures. So there would have been a bar graph that showed its total expenditures as greater than any other local government authority. The bar graph would have shown that its bonding is greater than any other local unit of government except the city of Minneapolis, the bonds that it had issued, and that its bonding, the bonds that it has out, would be larger than all the county units of government combined. And these are bonds, general obligation bonds, that are building sewers and roads at the edge of the region. These are bonds that are very significant public commitments. The Met Council's bonds that it issued have gone from about $500 million to $1 billion in the last decade. And these are very significant public commitments about where the region will build infrastructure, how it will decide to develop, whether it will decide to redevelop or develop new, who will get sewers, who will not get sewers, how land will be evaluated, which freeways will be designated as the MPO or the Metropolitan Planning Agency of the region decides where the freeways are built and in what order. These are significant issues. Now, there's a federal statute that provides for metropolitan planning organizations. It's 23 United States Code, Section 134. And in subsection 2, it says that every metropolitan organization that serves a metropolitan region of more than 50,000 people shall consist of, and under subsection A, it says local elected officials in this federal statute. And again, just for the record, this is Title 23 United States Code, Section 134.2. And as far as I'm aware, and I'm sure the Met Council will correct me if I'm wrong, there is not any other metropolitan planning organization in the United States that is not composed of elected officials. This is the only one in the United States that is composed of appointed officials. And this is done so by a special waiver in federal law that is sought by the local congressman to make sure that this complies with federal law. And one of the reasons that the Congress wanted metropolitan planning organizations, as they are created by the legislature, to be composed of local elected officials is because they form very important functions and perform very important tasks. So with that, I guess that is the sum and substance of the testimony. It has a budget of over $600 million a year, the third largest local unit of government in the state. It has $67 million of property taxes. It is the third largest local unit of government in the state. It has incredibly important discretionary decisions. And in the United States, from the founding, from the Declaration of Independence onward, local elected governments, local governments that have broad discretionary purpose and significant taxing power are directly elected. Now, you have certain special purpose governments that perform a single function or do one single thing, like a water board or a sewer board, that can be imposed of appointed officials, and there are many examples of that. But a broad general purpose government that has broad discretionary power and taxing and bonding authority, this is the American way. This is the way since Magna Carta, long history of Anglo-American constitutionalism is the founding principle.
All right. I apologize, Mr. Orfield, but we do finally have the slideshow available.
Okay.
Is there any picture or anything that you wanted to show us in particular?
I think I've summed it up. I think I'd like to provide this for the committee so that they can look at the budget and the bonding authority and think about the history of this and wonder whether there's any precedent for something that has these kind of significant discretionary authorities. And this was authored by Senator Harmon Ogdahl, who was Republican, and Bill Frenzel at the very beginning in 1967. When I was in the legislature four times, I authored it with the governor. We run a commission on local government affairs, that had recommended that it ought to be directly elected. So there's a long history of this as a bipartisan issue. It shouldn't be a partisan issue.
All right. Questions of Mr. Orfield before he has to leave. Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, in the spirit of nonpartisanship, right, which I do appreciate Representative Orfield mentioning. I'll first mention, Madam Chair, that I did have an opportunity. My very first debate as a legislator was with Representative Orfield on a different bill going in another direction as it pertained to the Metropolitan Council, and I enjoyed it tremendously. He was a gentleman to a wide-eyed deer in the headlights freshman legislator, and I think about that often. Thank you, Representative Orfield. I do have a question, though. You did talk about precedent, and I'd like to know, Representative Orfield, if you have any precedent of us creating a level of government such as this after the fact. I think the levels of government that we have currently, our cities, our townships, our counties, and then ultimately the state, were all created at the beginning, thoughtfully created, rather than a morphing of what 40 years ago was meant to be an advisory organization into a new level of government. Is there any precedent for that of having happened?
Mr. Orfield.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, thank you for the kind comments. There are seven levels of a local elected government. There are cities, counties, school districts, many levels of special districts that are often created and changed very frequently, the metropolitan level, obviously. Most of these, the cities that have been altered and continue to be altered by the laws of annexation and the structure of incorporation townships. Sometimes there are many communities in the state, particularly in the collar counties, that are changing their jurisdiction. The townships are and the cities are battling about annexation. Metropolitan planning organizations were first mandated by the federal government in the late 50s and early 60s. So this was a relatively new level of government that hadn't existed before. And there have been a fair number of changes in these over time. Most of them have been relatively stable, but many in the country have been changing and altering the scope and the size of their metropolitan planning organizations as they're settling into what they do. there really haven't been metropolitan level government since the 1950s. There are significant changes in the 60s and 70s, and now there have been a wave of changes in the 1990s about how these are constituted, what their powers are to be. The federal law, the Surface Transportation Act, gave the council new powers to be able to flex highways, where they could be flexed for transit. Many parts of the country responded to that by changing the composition of their metropolitan planning organizations. The Federal Clean Air Act created new duties and imposed new duties on metropolitan planning organizations for regions that go into non-attainment. So in both Congresses, Democratic and Republican, metropolitan planning organizations have tended to acquire new powers. Some of the most significant new powers were created between 1994 and 1998 under the Clean Air Act and the Surface Transportation Act and the Transportation and Efficiency Act. So there's a fair amount of reform and change in this level of government. Levels of government change all the time. Special districts are changing all the time. Counties change their duties. The Hennepin County Board, as I understand, just sort of took over the Minneapolis library system. And this is a kind of a new thing. I mean, this is what the legislature does, is reapportion these powers between.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Horfield, I do agree that powers and duties change, but we're actually looking at the creation of a brand new level of government and a pretty powerful level of government, as you see so rightly articulated. I guess the question, well, I'll take it a different direction. I think I've gotten that one. Is there another example of an MPO in the United States that is organizationally created as this bill envisions? In other words, where the metropolitan area is actually divided into relatively equal size districts, and then the membership actually runs for election. Will this be the first of its kind if it were to pass, or are there other examples nationwide?
Mr. Orfield.
Madam Chair and Representative Fiskins, I'm not aware of anything exactly like this. There's not a metropolitan planning organization that has the ability to bond and build new sewers or that I'm aware of that is directly running a transit system like this. So I'm not aware of anyone like this.
Okay.
I'm not aware of anything quite like the Metropolitan Council either.
A follow-up to that at all?
Madam Chair, just simply, I agree.
Okay. Questions from other members? All right. If not, thank you, Representative
Horn. Thank
you for that. Further testifiers?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Russ Adams from the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability, and Art Walzer from ISAIAH as well. And can I just quickly address that?
Certainly, Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskin, Representative Orfield was right. There's a similar, it doesn't have quite the same powers as the Met Council, but there is a metropolitan planning organization in Portland that is directly elected by districts. So it's mostly planning and land use functions.
All right. Mr. Adams, go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Russ Adams. I'm the director of the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability. It's a coalition of environmental, faith-based, and social justice advocacy groups that was founded by Representative Hornstein. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. Myron Orfield has talked about the scale of influence and impact of the Met Council and its budget. I want to make three points, one on accountability, another on independence, and a third on how we might elevate regional issues into the public debate. I'm passing out an outline of these comments for you, but in terms of accountability, the Met Council signs off on millions of dollars of public investments, water and sewer, roads, infrastructure, even land transfers, which have both a local and regional influence on growth and land development. The decision to make these investments ought to be transparent and accountable to local voters. On the topic of independence, tackling the thorniest public issues, including racial and economic disparities, the kinds of issues identified in the Mind the Gap report, which I'm sure you're familiar with, requires a more comprehensive approach. We need Met Council members who have the courage to speak out on these issues without fear of retribution or loss of their seat on a moment's notice. Currently, they serve at the pleasure of the governor. Met council members shouldn't have to look over their shoulder and wonder whether their values or efforts conflict with a particular governor's personal or political agenda. They ought to answer to voters directly. In terms of elevating regional issues into the public debate, we support a robust public dialogue about integration of land use, transportation, housing, and water quality issues in local and regional planning. Many of these issues are before you today. Having elected Met Council surfaces the great issues facing our region and places them prominently in the public realm. An elected Met Council promotes regional citizenship and ensures that residents in a particular council district get to choose a representative that best fits their needs. Instead of leaving it to chance, as others have said, the voters would make a choice on this. And then finally, Madam Chair, there are two arguments circulating about whether you should make this decision or not. One that's been mentioned in earlier hearings in the other body was that the turnover of elections every 4 years would cause disruptions in land use plans, that each new wave of elected council members, even if it was a wholesale change on every seat, would bring in people who'd want to change a blueprint or a land use plan that had existed for 4 or 5 years that was giving guidance to local cities in terms of their comprehensive planning. In the 12 years that I have been monitoring the Met Council, I have seen them rewrite 3 major land use plans. In 1996 and in 2002, they did brand new blueprints for each different governor, this appointed body, first for the Carlson administration, then for the Ventura administration, and then, shortly after 2002, the new Met Council, under the leadership of Chairman Bell, came in and rewrote a plan that had been passed by the Mondale Met Council, and by 2004 we had a new regional framework. So in 12 years, 3 new plans, and that's with an appointed body. And then secondly, Myra Northfield mentioned the concern about a partisan or parochial interest trumping regional interest if we elected Met Council members. The idea is that elected officials can't govern, they can't get along, they can't see the bigger regional picture, and therefore they'd be unable to get their work done. I think you'll agree that's either a weak argument against metro democracy or a strong argument for appointing this legislative body, and I think I know what side of the equation you fall on that. Thank you, and I'll take questions if there are any.
Questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Adams, why not a council of governments?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, a council of governments is an interesting idea. I would ask that what are the current duties and oversight that the Met Council retains would be in a council of governments, because some council of governments around in different areas of the country focus more on some issues but not the holistic approach that the Met Council does. So would it be wastewater and sewer, as well as signing off on major transportation investments and therefore being fitting the federal definition of an MPO and being able to spend federal transportation dollars? Would it be concerned with housing? Would it be concerned with water quality? So, a council of governments is an intriguing idea. It gets you closer to that accountability, locally elected officials. Well, what would be their regional authority?
And then Representative Holberg.
I guess the legislature could determine that just as they do with the Met Council. I'm not going to vote for Representative Holberg's bill as much as I like him. But I think we should have less government, not more. And somebody said to me, well, aren't you going to support the elected Met Council? I said, elect them. I want to neuter them. So I think we all have our own perspectives on this. But I think that you can, and we've seen models across the country. Well, we have Portland being elected, and we certainly have large regions across the country that figure these things out by local elected officials working together. And I think that a lot of your arguments could be addressed with getting some type of working group with county commissioners in the 7-county metro area. And in fact, if we change the model to something less intrusive, we may in fact be able to entice the collar counties to participate as well, which is becoming an increasing problem in dealing with regional issues.
Do you want to make a comment, Mr.?
Madam Chair, I'm mindful of your time, and Representative Holberg. I think the point where we might differ is the extent of the reach of a COG or of the Met Council. You and I might differ. I might see a more robust and aggressive council. I did have the pleasure a few years ago sitting in this very chamber and watching three bills pass out of here. One was a bill to study the Met Council. Another was a bill to elect the Met Council. And the third bill was a bill to abolish the Met Council. You might remember that. So, I mean, people do have different opinions.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was actually the same as Representative Holberg's, and I might just do a follow-up then. Suppose the answer to all your questions to her was yes, all those things. So assume all those things get done. Is there something inherently in this model that is better than...
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman.
Mr. Adams.
If I understand your point, the plan would be to elevate county commissioners into some sort of COG or...
Or a council of government, Madam Chair, depending on what the model is, people who were elected on the local level who then come together as a council of government, that might be city or county. I don't want to presuppose that, but so they're elected,
mm-hmm.
And they come together to perform the same functions as the Met Council. Is there something inherently better about this model than that?
Mr. Adams.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, it's difficult to comment on that without looking at the actual model. I do know that if I were to look at COGS for a model, I would probably look at San Diego, Denver, and Sacramento. They're known to have very forward-thinking, progressive COGs that integrate land use decisions in transportation and housing. They might go further than some members would be comfortable with. What you don't want to lose is this economy of scale that you have at this point at the Met Council, probably the finest water and sewer wastewater treatment system in the country, gets national awards for efficiencies. That helps in terms of linking water quality to land use planning. So it's difficult for me to say, unqualified yes without really seeing the model.
Follow up? All right. Further questions for Mr. Adams? Seeing none. Okay. Representative Hornstein, your next testifier.
We have one last testifier, Mr. Walzer from the Isaiah Organization.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Arthur Walzer, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the House File 312. Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to address you this afternoon. Isaiah is a coalition of 80 churches around the state, mostly in the metro area and St. Cloud. Last fall, and I'm here to talk about why elected Met Council seems like a good idea to an organization like ours, which attempts to organize the people who are in the pew around political action related to issues that we think are important and linked to our faith. And last fall, we sponsored six meetings in the metro area under the banner of Faith and Democracy. And there were some 5,000 people that attended those meetings. And Faith and Democracy is more than a slogan for us. We believe in democracy for two reasons, I think, essentially. One is that it's a good tool for political education of the ordinary citizen. When we hold meetings, we find the attendance is much better around election time. And people who don't ordinarily pay much attention to issues begin to get involved. Secondly, we think it's an opportunity for organizations like ours to establish a relationship with an elected official. During an election time, the power differential that is so pronounced the other way after election is clearly in the direction of the voters who are being wooed. So we find it the election itself to be a helpful tool. And I think with regard to citizen education, that if most people don't know what the Met Council is or who their representative is, it may be because of the appointed process. So both for the reasons of citizen education and for the opportunity to get a relationship going with a elected official, I think election is a good idea. I have another reason. On the other hand, when you look at the appointed process, I would like to relate a story, an example that I had in that regard. The problems that I have were tellingly illustrated with the appointment of Annette Meeks to represent one of the districts in Minneapolis in 2005. I think, as many of you know, Annette Meeks was formerly the director of the Center for American Experiment. And that group had authored a report that argued for the elimination of the Met Council. And one of the reasons in the report, the primary reason given for that, was that Minneapolis, in her opinion, in the report's opinion, excuse me, had gotten a disproportionate amount of the Livable Community Act funds. And so it seemed particularly ironic that somebody who argued for the elimination of the council on the grounds that the district that she was now representing received a disproportionate amount would now be representing that that district. So our Isaiah group wanted to meet with her. We have churches in her district. And I was asked to make the appointment. And I called, and it was extremely hard to get her to respond. And finally she said to me that she wouldn't deal with me or talk to me because I wasn't a member. I wasn't in her district. I live in St. Paul. So we had other people that were in her district try to have a meeting with her to see whether she would want to distance herself from the views in the report, to see, you know, what her plans were. After repeated efforts, we finally got a meeting, which she canceled. And then we rescheduled the meeting, and we were hoping to have 25 people in the room, so, you know, it wasn't easy to orchestrate. We rescheduled the meeting, and then at the last minute she asked that it be moved from the Minneapolis location where we had planned it in her district to the Met Council offices. And this was impossible for us to arrange at the last minute, so we canceled it. Now, Isaiah is a very tenacious organization. I think some of you know that. We are persistent in asking a public official to meet with us. She beat us. She defeated us. She managed to avoid that. Now, in my years with Isaiah, that's been about 12 years, I have scheduled dozens of meetings with public officials, with city council members, with mayors, with representatives, senators. Nothing like this, remotely like this, have I ever experienced. I find that Minnesota public officials are extraordinarily accessible to citizens, at least when they're elected. Thank you.
Further comments, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just before I know that there'll be some opponents testifying, I did want to very briefly explain my oral amendment. Would you like to do that later? Or?
Please finish your presentation, and then we'll let Mr. Bell go, and then we'll ask for public testimony.
One of the main arguments against this House file, there's several, and you know we've addressed those, but one in particular has come up related to the Central Corridor. And in your packets, there's a letter from Congresswoman McCollum that addresses this question, and from my conversations with her office and with the FTA, it has not risen to a concern. Basically, that argument is an elected Met Council, particularly going into effect in 2008, would cause potential problems for the full funding agreement for the Central Corridor. So I don't believe that's a concern. However, members, because I think this was very important to the Met Council and in their conversations with me raised it, that's why I moved that oral amendment so that the effective date is 2010. So if there is an issue, and of course there's both sides to this, the Met Council argue there is. From our contacts in Washington, we believe it isn't. But to erase any doubt, I wanted to send a message that we want to work with you know, the Met Council and any other stakeholders who have concerns about the Central Corridor, and just simply put out the effective date so that this wouldn't be an issue or a question. And if we need to amend it further to address those concerns, I'm open to that. So it's a compromise, but I believe it's a compromise in the best interest of the region and those who view this as a potential issue.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, do you have any resolutions of support from local units of government in the metropolitan area in support of this legislation, county boards, city councils, and the like?
No, there have been. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Representative Lanning. No, we don't. We're in conversations with various entities. Presentation was made, for example, at the North Metro Mayor's meeting last week. I've had some individual conversations with county commissioners, one of whom was interested in this council of governments idea. But I think in general, there's, I think, broad consensus that there does need to be some reform within the Metropolitan Council. But in terms of your question, we don't have formal resolutions. I don't know if Mr. Jamboy is here. The Association of Metropolitan Municipalities is neutral on this, but I know that they have some insights that, that may address your question as well.
Representative Lanning.
Just a follow-up. Having been a former local official and a member of the Metropolitan Council of Governments that worked very effectively, I know I would be very concerned as a local official about a bill that would elect folks that could be another layer of government that we have to work with. And that's why I was wondering if you have received support from local officials here in the metro area. Thank you.
Representative Lanning, we're having public testimony, so I'm certain that if any of the organizations that represent local elected officials have something to say, they'll come to the table and share their views with us. So thank you. All right. With that, Representative Hornstein, I'm going to ask if there's anyone. First, we'll do Peter Bell from the Metropolitan Council, and then I'll ask if anyone in the audience wishes to testify for or against the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Mr. Bell comes forward, Representative Hornstein, just so I understand your amendment a little clearer, the moving out to 2010, was the purpose of that basically because you believe that the New Starts process on the Central Corridor will have been concluded by that time? Because as I look at the attachment to the letter by Congresswoman McCollum, it seems to me that the only reason the FTA does not see this elected Met Council as a problem is because the FTA isn't answerable to the Metropolitan Council to begin with. They're answerable to the TAB board, right? And so I guess, would you envision that in 2010 the TAB board's function rolls over to this newly elected Metropolitan Council, or what, just time to study and work together? Again, I need a little more clarity on the purpose for your amendment.
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskin, that is absolutely correct that the TAB board is the entity that needs to be dealt with here. But as you know, the TAB, which is the Transportation Advisory Board, is makes recommendations that ultimately the Met Council then approves. And so there would have to be a new relationship, if you will, between the TAB board and the Metropolitan Council, simply because the council would be elected and then is then responsible for some of these TAB appointments. And but I don't envision this process changing the composition of the TAB board, but there would certainly be a new relationship if it were elected.
All right, Mr. Bell, go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Bell, and I'm Chair of the Metropolitan Council. It's a pleasure to come before you today to address the issue of an elected Met Council. Madam Chair, I believe never does the cliche of if it's not broke, don't fix it apply more than the situation before us today. I believe, while I'm not a disinterested party, that the Met Council enjoys today a broader and deeper level of support than perhaps it has ever enjoyed. I think the question that Representative Hornstein was addressed to him a minute ago is an important one, and that is, do the municipalities, the 189 municipalities in the 7-county area, support this change? What is ironic to me is the what I would argue is the strong record of support that the Met Council has enjoyed over the past 4 years. And I will list some of those points of success briefly. Opening up of the Hiawatha Light Rail Line, getting the North Star Commuter Rail Line moving forward, developing the 2030 framework, increasing transit ridership by about 4 or 5%, a AAA credit rating, implementing the Livable Communities Grant Programs, running the HRA program, and, was stated earlier, running one of the best wastewater treatment programs in the world. One point I need to make before I get into my direct remarks is I need to respectfully challenge the remarks by Art Walzer from Isaiah. I don't want this committee to go away thinking that the Met Council is not responsive. I have personally met with Isaiah. I have met with the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability as well. Whenever they've asked to meet with me, and I think both of them would acknowledge this, I have been very open and receptive, as we are with meeting with a broad array of groups. I would not believe that receptivity or the lack thereof is based upon whether you're elected or not. A number of concerns that I'll list briefly about an elected Met Council. First is that an elected council would inevitably become more independent. Members would have districts more than twice the size of state senators and more than four times the size of House members, 175,000 persons per district. I believe that the council shows in general in its history, and this council particularly, an appropriate amount of deference to elected officials. I think the best example of that, Madam Chair, is the situation with Lake Elmo. After winning in the courts all the way up to the Supreme Court, we still negotiated a settlement that I think could be characterized as both sides could live with it with Lake Elmo. I'm not at all convinced that kind of deference and cooperative working arrangement would take place if the Met Council were elected. Second, I believe that elected Met Council unquestionably would be more parochial. I think individual members would run on platforms of transit or parks or wastewater or a livable communities grants. They would essentially say, if we don't get that bus stop or we don't get that transit route or we don't get that park, or if you don't agree not to put wastewater in our community, we will not support programs for other council members. In total, really, I'm saying is that the regional focus of the council would be lost on the altar of parochial interests and platforms that various candidates would run on. Third, this legislation could easily undermine the partnerships the council has built for carrying out its responsibilities. As I mentioned, we collaborate with 189 communities on comprehensive planning. Similar concerns, I think, would exist regarding the relationships that we have with the 10 park implementing agencies. What if, for example, that the administration supported a project and the elected Met Council did not? So the governor would support a project, but the majority of the Met Council didn't, or vice versa. What kind of gridlock would that create in our region? This is a very important point, Madam Chairman. There is no guarantee that an elected Met Council would be supportive of rail transit ways or transit at all. There are only four current council districts representing the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Coincidentally, 63% of our weekday bus service runs through these four districts. So in other words, 63% of our transit is in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and you would have the vast majority of the members of the Met Council outside of those four districts. How supportive would they be of transit in the inner city given that configuration? Also, 60% of the entire transit budget is funded by the state through MVEST or general fund appropriations. 60%. The remainder is mostly covered through fares, 26%, and federal grants, 8%. With an appointed council, the legislature, you folks, can and do have greater influence over those appropriations than you would if there was an elected Met Council. You folks can exert much more influence over transit activities because 60% of our funds come from the state. If it was an elected council, that would not be the case. Federal law provides that we have a metropolitan planning organization, as was discussed earlier, MPO for this region, through which federal funds flow. The MPO is created by agreement between the governor and elected officials representing at least 75% of the metropolitan area. It's important to note that this is reviewed every 3 years by the feds. If the Metropolitan Council were elected, the Met Council could lose its MPO designation. So the whole status of the Met Council as a metropolitan planning organization could be changed because it is an agreement that has been established. The effects of this outcome could have significant impacts on how federal funds for roads and transit projects would be processed because another MPO would have to be established for the region. So if there was an elected Met Council, there is no assurance that that would continue as it does now. It is anticipated that major delays would be the best case scenario for any regional projects currently in the federal funding process. Much has been discussed about the impact on the Central Corridor, and I think it would be potentially significant. The FTA does what is known as a risk assessment. They try to come into a project and assess the risk. A major criteria for the risk assessment is governance. And if the governance for any kind of transitway or transit project were in question, this would give the FTA ample reason to delay or slow down a project until that issue were resolved. This is a major and important consideration that the feds use in determining should they go forward. Fourth, an elected Met Council may not be as balanced, diverse, and representative of the region as a council appointed by the governor. The governor can assure that the council includes members with experience in local government, business, and law. He can ensure it includes members with historical knowledge of the region. He can assure that it provides for racial and gender balance. Currently, there are 3 individuals of color and 8 women. Under our present system, the Met Council is accountable to both the governor and the legislature. The council chair and its 16 members are appointed by and serve at the pleasure of the governor. These appointments are subject to Senate confirmation. The council chair is a member of the governor's cabinet and is accountable to him, just like every other state commissioner. The councilor's budget, appropriations, and bonding requests are reviewed annually by multiple committees in both the House and the Senate. I myself have been before this committee on numerous occasions during this legislative session.
Mr. Bell, about how much do you have left?
A minute or two, Madam
Perfect.
Chair.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Much is made of the fact that the council is taxing authority. Of the council's $665 million budget for 2007, most of the revenues come from user charges, from our wastewater system, passenger fares, from transit users, and state appropriations that the legislature must approve. Just 10% comes from local property taxes, and these are levered under a statutory ceiling established by the legislature. I am at a loss for Professor Orfield's contention that only special purpose districts have levying authority. I don't understand how that makes them any less onerous regarding the issue of taxation without representation. I wish you were here to address that question. The current council has kept our property tax levy flat for 4 successive years, achieving operational efficiencies and moving into a new building that will save taxpayers $14 million. The Metropolitan Council has not always been the most understood or appreciated unit of government. Over the last 4 years, we have worked very hard to reach out to the public and key stakeholders, to listen to them, and to build strong working relationships. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bell. Questions for Mr. Bell? Seeing none, is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Go ahead. Please come to the table. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Jason Flores. I'm here today representing the Metropolitan Coalition of Chambers, an association of 25 metro area chambers of commerce representing business in more than 60 communities. We formed MCC 5 years ago as an advocate for significant investment and improvement in the Twin Cities transportation infrastructure. MCC has worked primarily on funding issues here at the legislature, but we have also monitored regional governance issues as they relate to transportation. We have, since our formation, advocated for better coordination and integration of transportation projects in the metro area, and we fully support the current plan as presented by the Metropolitan Council. However, MCC does have several concerns with the proposal to elect a Metropolitan Council. Many of them will echo points already made by Mr. Bell, and thus I'll be brief. First, we support increased coordination and cooperation in transportation. This bill would not help in achieving that goal. Instead, it would add yet another level of complexity and compound already competing interests. Currently, the Council works well with local elected officials. However, if elected, it could lead to unnecessary political tensions and increased parochialism that would interfere with long-term planning efforts. Independent elections for the Met Council would also harm the strong working relationships in place between the administration, any administration, and the Council, which would further delay policy implementation. Changing the governance structure just as several large projects are coming online could also further delay construction and potentially lead to loss of federal funds to other competing metro areas. While the oral amendment may address some of those concerns as related to the Central Corridor is not the last major transit investment will be made. What if the Southwest Transitway is just coming online in the same position that the Central Corridor will be in 2008, and what effect will that have on another very important leg, for example, of the Metro Transit system? Finally, the current structure of the Metropolitan Council already allows for political responsiveness and accountability without directly exposing council members to the pressures of electoral politics. In Minnesota, we've recently experienced a difficulty in addressing transportation funding through the political process, and it's a lack of funding that's caused for construction delays and stunted development and transit options, not that there's not plans in place already. The Met Council does have a large budget and bonding authority, but this is authority the legislature has granted to the council, allowing for much more oversight by the legislature under the current system than if the council were independently elected. In conclusion, Madam Chair, we have serious concerns with this bill, and believe that the current system of appointment for the Metropolitan Council best serves the transportation needs of the metro area as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Who else is in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Please come down so that I can at least see who we are and how many we have left. Looks like just one. Okay, Mr. Jamboy, please state your name for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. We call ourselves Metro Cities these days. Metro Cities is neutral on the election of a Met Council. Metro Cities supports a metropolitan governance structure that provides public services and conducts planning efforts, but we're silent on what that organization ought to be. The last time our organization studied this issue in serious depth was in 1998, and the membership was divided on a Met Council. No consensus was reached, though there was an awful lot of passion, so I guess we're passionately neutral about this issue. Our current policy, again, talks about an open public selection process and staggered terms. It doesn't talk about a specific type of governance structure. Interestingly enough, we have over 60 policies in our organization, and each policy is discussed each summer. Some generate significant discussion, and the Met Council does generate significant discussion in our policy committees, but it centers mostly around how much authority the Met Council should or should not have. And in general terms, I would say that the core cities that and inner ring suburbs, and the closer you are to the core, those cities, relatively speaking, would like to see more Met Council authority. The farther away you get from the core, those cities would like to see less Met Council authority. All cities would like to see the Met Council step up to the plate in transportation funding. But this issue, the issue of an elected Met Council, has not really generated a lot of discussion in my tenure at Metro Cities. If I had to boil the issue down into two pieces, it would be direct accountability to voters, which is, of course, a legitimate concern, and deference to other local elected officials and state officials, and that's a concern, too. For you, I believe that's sort of the fundamental bottom line. For us, it is a matter of authority and how much authority the Met Council should or should not have. And with that, Madam Chair, I will end.
Thank you. Final questions before we go to vote. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this is to the author of the bill. Is that
absolutely?
Go ahead.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, I'm going to point out a few issues in the bill I think you should consider. I'm not going to make any recommendations for amendments because I'm hoping that the bill will rest comfortably right here for the remainder of session. But Representative Hornstein, in regards to your amendment as to the general election, I will point out that on page 15, line 33, you rightfully point out that there needs to be adjustments at the decennial census point, and then which is to 2010. So you're going to have the first election 2010. There's going to have to be a reapportionment, and so 2012. You're going to have people voting in brand new districts, all right? And I think that creates some logistical problems. I also wonder, Representative Hornstein, about your 10% buffer. I wonder if that will withstand constitutional muster, if you can have a 10% buffer between, and whether the constitutional mandate of one man, one vote holds up under a 10% buffer. But the biggest question that I have, Representative Hornstein, that I'd like you to enlighten this committee, if you would please, could you spell out for us in specific terms what is there about the current Met Council that you don't like? What is there about the current Met Council that is not working? What is there about the current Met Council that needs to be fixed, that is broken? I'd like to hear you share that with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Biskin. Let's look at it this way. We're making a good agency better. In all sincerity, I think that in many ways I served on the Met Council. It is a good agency. But right now we're at a point that it's a very critical crossroads for the region. And we are potentially going to get significant federal dollars for a significant transportation plan. But I would argue, Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, that the issue is not the structure of the council in terms of its being appointed and changing from an appointed to an elected council that is going to cause problems with the FDA as has been represented here. In my conversations, Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, members, it's our lack of a dedicated source for transit year in and year out, notwithstanding MBEST, and quite frankly, our legislatures in action and the executive branches in action on this issue that puts into jeopardy far more than the structure, far more than this particular short-term issue with the Central Corridor that I've addressed. You know, now they're saying, it's going to affect the Southwest Corridor and everything else. What's going to affect funding and implementation for those corridors is our ultimate commitment as a legislature and an executive branch to have a dedicated source for funding. I believe, and finally, Madam Chair, and this will be my closing comment, because I know you've got a very long agenda, and we have a long few weeks ahead of us. So I will just conclude, Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, with your question, what is wrong with the current council? It's not a question of the current council specifically. I mean, I have concerns with cuts in livable communities and the similar concerns that were raised with an inability of a member to meet with their constituents. But I am not a Johnny-come-lately to this issue. In 1995, when I first got involved with
forming a Metropolitan Council watchdog group, if you will, the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability, we were involved in an important issue, the Elm Creek Interceptor Project, a $70 million project that was going to be the first test of a new Met Council policy that would link infrastructure investments to affordable housing, land use planning, etc. And there was a lot of interest in this issue, and what we ended up doing is asking the Met Council members to have a field hearing with concerned citizens. This was completely out of their experience, and after negotiations for 2 or 3 months with the chair, we did have a field hearing, and over 200 people attended. This was the first and perhaps only example of this kind of hearing that I have experienced in over three administrations that I've seen, you know, with the Met Council. I think we did a little better under Mondale because there were actual professionals involved in engaging with the community. But it really is, for me, the bottom line, members, community engagement of a very important agency that has very, very critical taxing and spending powers. And without that community engagement, which is very much lacking, Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, we are not going to have the kind of agency that this region needs and deserves. We will have much better community involvement and community engagement. I talked to one of the freshman legislators the other day, has not had a single contact with their Met Council member. No one's introduced themselves. The council member hasn't. And this is just pretty much par for the course. It's really about community engagement and community involvement. And that's why I'm bringing this bill forward.
All right, we have two questions on the list. Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, and I maybe this was asked earlier, I was not here the first 12 minutes. Why a public subsidy for these people running in this election? I mean, do we do this for Hennepin County Sheriff, for Ramsey County Sheriff? And I'm just not aware of that. And is there going to be a fiscal note on this, and this will go to some finance committees? Because it looks like a pretty high price tag.
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair and Representative House, the answer to your questions, no, these local units of government have their own modus operandi in terms of how they deal with campaign finance-related issues. But there have been concerns if we had big money candidates, for example, running for these positions, is there something that could equal the playing field? And so that's the idea of having a system similar to what we have here at the legislature. And the Met Council is a creature of the legislature. So a lot of this bill just simply adds the Met Council to current statute that regulates us.
All right.
Just a follow-up.
Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, maybe the best way to avoid suspicion of big money politics would be to have them appointed.
Madam Chair, Representative House, we have had appointed officials that have had conflicts of interest over the years on the Met Council. And so, I think that's a wash in terms of this argument. We have not had a lot of developers stepping up, for example, in Portland, maybe one or two. And we've had mainly local elected officials in that community that have stepped up to run. And obviously some nonprofits and other concerned citizens. So, I think we already have a problem with that, Madam Chair and Representative House. And, you know, we're just anticipating an argument that people have made to us.
Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Weinstein, how many elected House members are in the Metro Council? I'm just trying to figure out how many each of these Met Council members would represent if there were 16 of them. Would there be more legislators or more council members?
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair and Representative Schumper, there'd be more legislators. There's no question about it. As Chair Bell pointed out, these are fairly large districts. But currently, again, these are large districts that have really no engagement, little to no engagement with their person that's ostensibly representing them at the Metropolitan Council. Very rare will you see a Metropolitan Council member at a neighborhood meeting, at a city council meeting, at a community meeting of any kind. And I find that unconscionable.
All right, Representative Shumper, one question, and then we have Representative Biskin, and then we're going to vote.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, will local elected officials be able to run and serve in these spots as well as have their local elected office?
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair and Representative Shumper, I view this as a part-time job. I think it would be very problematic for a local elected official to serve both. We don't have that here. And I think that's also one of the issues, quite frankly, that I have with the Council of Governments model. If a Met Council member is a county commissioner or a city council member, would their Met Council responsibilities be, you know, fifth on a list of, items in their job description? I'm not sure they would be able to give it the time it deserves.
All right, Representative Biskin, last question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. Yeah, I think that this is probably one of the most important bills this committee can deal with because, look at the title of the committee, Metropolitan Governance. This is huge. This is a big deal. So, Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. Representative Hornstein, I think the answer to Representative Shumper's question is obviously no because, of course, you can't be on the ballot twice for two different elected offices, so the answer would clearly be no. But Representative Hornstein, you talked about community engagement as being the issue. Now, you had a testifier up here who pointed to a very specific issue, a problem that they had with a very specific member. Sounded more like a personal vendetta, and I'm not sure we should be changing the entire composition of the board because of that, of the council. But what problems? I need to delve into this because it is the crux of the matter. What problems have arisen? Can you point to specific problems that have arisen out of this perceived lack of community engagement? And I'm with you for changing the composition if you can tell me what the problems are that have arisen, and specific examples would be very helpful.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, the specific example of a legislator newly elected who has absolutely no idea who their Met Council member is, has absolutely no relationship, is, I would argue, is a problem. The fact that we had, in this case, a Met Council member not meeting is a problem. I think the fact that very few members of the public really know who their Met Council member is or what the functions of the Met Council are. I believe that's very problematic for an agency that has, it's very important to the region and has vast responsibilities and taxation powers, as Representative Warfield pointed out.
I see Judd standing over here. All right, go ahead.
I'll be very quick. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and Representative Hornstein is a very, very good friend of mine, and I would just like to debate one particular issue, is that I'm sure every member in this committee and every member of the Minnesota Legislature who represents any district within the metropolitan area receives at the beginning of every biennium a list from the council listing every council member, every contact information, every grant that the council has ever placed in their district, whether it's livable communities, wastewater. It explains the entire wastewater system for their particular district and every transit route, every transit way, and we go above and beyond just to make sure that members of the legislatures are aware of who the council is, what we do. And I can appreciate what Representative Hornstein is saying as far as the new council members, but we do make a point to do that, and I'm sure that every one of you who are sitting in on this committee and are serving in the legislature have received that packet of information, because I put it together myself, sent it to every one of you with contact information for each one of those folks. So maybe I need to get the poker out a little bit, get people to turn around and call their legislators. I know we have some members up in Anoka County. We have a council member by the name of Natalie Hostefan, who I think does probably the greatest amount of constituent service that anybody that I have ever seen. We have Councilmember Peggy Lepic, who represents Frank's district, who meets with her regularly, or meets with Frank regularly, at least once a year, if not twice a year, in his particular district, which was, that just happened, I think, last over the summer. I try to attend those meetings as well. And one other point I want to make quick is regarding the letter that you received from Congresswoman McCollum's district. It states in there that the Metropolitan, it was from Stephen Fong, who happens to be a staff person in the government affairs at the FTA. Mr. Fong incorrectly states that the council is not the MPO and that the TAB is the MPO, and that is an incorrect statement. I have the letter from then-Governor Wendy Anderson that states the council is the MPO. We have been for the past 31 years, and we go through the process every 3 years being recognized by the FTA. And as far as how this will relate to the Central Corridor, all those federal funds have to go through us and send through the TAB, who works as a partner of ours. But I just wanted to point that out, and I will appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Chair, I'm done.
All right. All right. I do intend to vote now, so at this point I will renew my motion that House File 312 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Governmental Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
All those in favor signify by raising your hand. All those opposed, raise your hand. I have great ears. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
All right. Next is House File 465, Senate File 321, Representative Cram.
Which one are we taking up?
Actually, we're taking up Senate File 321, and I would move that Senate File 321 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Kranz has been before this committee before, and there were some questions that were unable to be answered, and so with him today is Niles Zinkman, and to clear up anything that we might have questions about. So with that, Representative Kranz, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for bringing us back and the movement. If you remember, when we were here last time, we had with us the purchasing officer for the equipment for the fire department, for the nonprofit fire department, and there were some questions that the committee had, both on status of nonprofit versus volunteer, and also the extent of the drain powers agreement. I now have with me today the chief, who has all the answers, and hopefully we can move through this quickly. So without further ado, then I will turn the mic over to Chief Niles Zinkman.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Niles Zinkman, Fire Chief, Spring Lake Park, Plain, Mounds View Fire Department. And again, thank you for allowing me to come back and hear the bill again. A little bit of history on the nonprofit. Nonprofit fire departments exist in the state of Minnesota to the tune of about 80 of us. They're primarily in the Arrowhead region and a few down here in the metro. The reason they exist is twofold. One is we predate the organization of cities. That's our case. The fire department organized in 1944. The first city in our district didn't organize until 1958. And the systems have just evolved, and they're actually highly efficient in terms of fiscal cost. The other reason they exist, give the example up in Arrowhead, is there's no single political subdivision large enough to support a fire department on its own. So you'll see a nonprofit organize and then service, for example, two or three or five townships. The state law allows statutory, municipal, and nonprofits, and so those are the three types, and the vast majority is municipal, and then the nonprofits.
All right. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my question was, why can't the local municipalities or townships enter into a joint powers and accomplish the same thing on your behalf?
Mr. Zinkman.
Chair and Representative Holberg, they can. They do form joint powers agreements, but there are some distinct advantages to the nonprofits, and there's also some distinct advantages to just leave what's working well enough alone, if you will. There are a number of joint powers fire departments out there. They're considered municipal. But for example, to undo our nonprofit, in our case, would trigger their joint powers agreement and the liquidation of assets and cause a fair amount of disruption.
Representative Holberg.
Well, Madam Chair, and I guess maybe I wasn't clear enough. I'm not suggesting that you undo your nonprofit firefighting corporation, but if your nonprofit firefighting corporation involves three townships, why can't those three townships do a joint powers agreement for the purchase of your materials or supplies? In other words, why do we have to extend an authority to you that the local units of government already have and can work together to help provide you what you need?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, the typical fashion which a nonprofit fire corporation works is we negotiate a contract with a set amount for the capital and the operating budget, and once that money is transmitted over into our budget and our control, then those entities look for us to just go out and make those purchasing decisions appropriately and not necessarily, you know, in my case, go back to all three cities. There's some nonprofits out there servicing seven, and so they actually look to that efficient model and that one entity that has the expertise. Once they approve the expenditure, okay, they would just soon hand that purchase off, and this bill would just allow us to get the best possible price. And again, they have limited resources where they're servicing townships. You know, my three cities do have some more purchasing, but they just soon hand that off and let us, you know, go spend that money, you know, once they've approved the budget process.
Further questions? All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, I would renew my motion that Senate File 321 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
And, Madam Chair, just real briefly, does your status as nonprofit allow you to make these purchases tax-free, sales tax-free?
Representative Holberg, that is correct. As a nonprofit entity, we do enjoy tax-free purchasing.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
All right. Next on the agenda is House File 905, Representative Skelzy. Representative Skelzy, this bill would be moved to the general register if you'd like to make that motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would. I'm Representative Bev Skelzy, and I would like to move House File 905 to be approved and passed to the general register. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a handout coming around that explains a little bit of what happened in Maple Grove regarding this. First of all, this bill has come from the League of Minnesota Cities. This bill passed the House last year. It did not make it out of the Senate. And it's about a city's wellness program. And currently, cities lack the authority to spend money on employee wellness recognition programs. The counties do, and the state does, but currently cities do not. So this bill would extend that authority to local units of government, and then they could provide preventive health and employee recognition services. And I think you could see from the handout regarding Maple Grove how they actually decreased costs for health insurance by conducting their city program. And I have with me today Lori Elliott from Shoreview, and she'll introduce herself and talk about her part of this program.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Lori Elliott. I'm the Human Resources Manager for the City of Shoreview. Excuse me. And thank you. That was a very nice summary of what this bill is about. Currently, the state and the counties can operate wellness programs for their staff, and cities would like the same authority to do so, primarily as a cost containment measure. And as you can see from the Maple Grove handout on page 2, they're demonstrating their savings by, for each dollar spent on their wellness program, how much they're managing to save.
And I think this is a dramatic link, really, between wellness and health insurance. Also, I think, you know, in the interest of cost containment, cities are starting to move towards these high-deductible health plans. I can tell you at Shoreview, the first $1,000 if you're sick or injured comes out of your own pocket. So we have some highly motivated employees who are now trying to figure out, how can I save this money? How can I, you know, get myself in some sort of shape so that I don't have to expend that $1,000? And preventative programs are really a good way to do that. And we can guide that motivation in sort of a positive direction. And I think I sort of enjoy saying this, and I don't really like hearing it, but lifestyle choices have a significant impact on the cost of health insurance. If we all weighed the appropriate amount, we all ate more fruits and vegetables, we exercised regularly, you know, we went to the dentist more often, more research is coming out about that, we, you know, drank in moderation, quit smoking, blah, 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 we could take a lot out of the healthcare stream of money and costs. And like I said, I don't really like to hear it, because that means I need to exercise and eat more fruits and vegetables and do all those things. But we can really significantly impact what health insurance is costing us. And that's the point of a wellness-type program. And I think there's also the trickle-down effect. Well, we're really trying to impact our employees. You know, if they're carrying family insurance and we get them on a walking program, you know, nobody wants to walk by themselves. So then it's like, come on, walk with me. Or, okay, I'm going to take my kids out and bike with them. Or I'm going to do something to be more active. So I think there's some benefits there as well, other influence that goes on within the household. The Maple Grove statistics also talk about an impact on their workers' compensation claims, and that's about four pages in, where they're seeing that they've saved over the past 10 years about $32,000. So, and I think logic and common sense just kind of go hand in hand, that, you know, more fit employees are going to be less expensive for you. I also, as a human resources manager, see this as just one more tool in my toolkit to work with employees and improve our work environment and improve their health, and as a way to save and cost, save costs for them and for us. And we're just seeking a level playing field with the state and county employees. And also, we do have support from both the former and current state auditor for this change.
All right. Questions?
Thank you.
All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Scalzi renews her motion that House File 905 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Scalzi, next you have House File 935, Senate File 736, and this one can go to the consent calendar if it passes this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move to pass Senate File 736 and move it to the consent calendar. It's already passed the Senate consent calendar. That's why we're working on a Senate file. This is a name change, and I always hate to hear people say this is a non-controversial bill. It's a really short bill, but this one really is. And I have with me here Keith Carlson from the newly named, or soon to be newly named, Minnesota Intercounty Association.
All right, Mr. Carlson, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I am Keith Carlson. I am executive director of what's now the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Our association changed its bylaws back in December and subsequently amended its articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State's office to reflect the name change that, in our board of directors' opinion, better reflected the nature of our organization, which was previously named the Metropolitan Intercounty Association, to now the Minnesota Intercounty Association, to reflect the fact that 8 of our 13 members are from Greater Minnesota. There are 3 places in the statutes where our organization is referenced, and the bill before you simply changes that reference in comporting with the new name of the organization. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, as I see we're dropping the Metropolitan and changing it to Minnesota, would it be a friendly amendment to drop the Metropolitan from Metropolitan Council, turn it to the Minnesota Council, and fold in the other 80 counties?
Representative Scalzi.
Ms. Chair and Representative Viskins, I think that would be a great idea because we could spread the taxing capacity around to the whole state rather than the metro city. It's a good idea.
I think it would have to come off the consent calendar at this point.
That might expand the scope of the bill, Madam Chair, by just a little bit.
A little bit, Representative Viskins. Anyone else? Representative House.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I see, has two bills up in the same day. She bringing cookies tomorrow.
We don't meet tomorrow.
The next day.
All right. Further questions? All right. Hearing none, all those in, Representative Scalzi renews her motion that Senate File 736 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right, with that, House File 755, and members, we're back on schedule. So, Representative Hansen, I would move that House File 577 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee. Go ahead, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rick Hansen, South St. Paul. And I have with me Doug Thomas from the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak to House File 577. This is my first time appearing in front of your committee, and hopefully it will not be the last. But I have here today, I'm going to hand out some lists if the page could... This is an end product. This bill is an end product of about a year of work between a very diverse group of stakeholders, including the Association of Minnesota Counties, Watershed Districts, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Minnesota Conservation Federation, a lot of people who usually don't sit down together on issues. And this is particularly an issue relating to drainage. And what this bill does is it comes off of a report that was provided to the legislature last in January of 2006 that looked at the science, the literature review relating to establishing vegetative buffers along drainage systems. And one of the recommendations of that report, it talked about the benefits in terms of water quality, erosion control, and wildlife habitat. It made some recommendations to have a task force to look at coming back to the legislature. That task force met throughout the summer and fall and developed a number of consensus recommendations. And those recommendations come to you today in House File 577. Recommendations were also included in the governor's budget with some appropriations a little bit different than what you see in the bill. But just in summary, this legislation is the result of a great deal of work by a great number of people, many of whom are in the audience today, who have worked and want to continue working on these issues relating to buffers along drainage ditches. And with that, I'll refer to Doug Thomas to walk through the bill. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Thomas, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And as Representative Hansen said, the bill you have in front of you today is basically a result of a two-year effort. The bill relates basically to Minnesota Chapter 103E, which is the state's drainage law, sometimes referred to the ditch law. From a local government perspective, it's counties and watershed districts who are the two local governments that are charged in the act to serve as the state's public drainage authorities. And so I think it's important to make the connection that those are the two local governments that are identified and are charged with acting as public drainage authorities. To walk through the bill fairly quickly for you, Section 1 of the bill is a technical change. These are all changes to Chapter 103E or to the Drainage Code. It's a technical change that clarifies the point of beginning of where the vegetative buffer strip is measured from, and then how that 16.5-foot perennial vegetative buffer
is measured from that point of beginning. So we really think of that as primarily a technical change. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill are primarily conforming changes. One of the things we did is change the word grass to perennial vegetation to give our drainage authorities more options as far as the choice of vegetation that is planted on that buffer strip. That buffer strip serves the purpose of keeping equipment away, so it maintains the efficiency of the drainage system by keeping equipment away, keeping sediment from eroding into the drainage system, as well as providing some water quality and some wildlife benefits. Section 4 of the bill is probably the biggest change. It's a new section, and it provides an authority for the public drains authorities that provides an incremental approach to establishing those vegetative buffer strips along public drainage systems. And it does that by providing a way for the authority to utilize a repair procedure. They're still required to appoint an engineer or appoint viewers to go out and determine the cost and the damages. And it continues to utilize the same due process that's in current law so that every landowner that's along that public drainage system has full opportunity. They receive public notice. They receive a statement of benefits and damages and also an opportunity to be heard and to present their concerns about a proceeding at the time that it takes place. Section 5 of the bill adds some annual reporting requirements to Chapter 103E. I guess it's kind of viewed as the transparency piece to provide information back to the state on the status of how many inspections are being done every year, how many compliance actions are being taken, the number of new buffer strips that are being required to be implemented, as well as the number and types of actions that the public drainage authorities are undertaking in the bill. Section 6 of the bill is, again, fairly straightforward. It makes sure that when a ditch is cleaned out or improved, they're actually moving dirt. We discovered there are some situations where that dirt can be placed adjacent to the ditch, and if there's conservation lands, lands that are enrolled in a state or federal program such as CRP or the Rim Reserve Program, we were finding problems where county attorneys were instructing the drainage authority to say, you're not required to go out there and to reseed that area or to pay that landowner for their cost of reseeding that grass buffer strip, which actually puts that landowner in a kind of a catch-22 position because they could potentially be in violation of their federal or state contract or easement that they may have. So it makes it clear that that is a responsibility of the drainage authority. Section 7, again, is simply a conforming change, replacing grass with perennial vegetation. Section 8 of the bill, again, is another place where we clarify where if there is disturbance or destruction to the grass buffer strip by a repair activity, that, again, it's the responsibility of the drainage authority to make that whole. And then Section 9 of the bill adds a requirement that the minimum period for inspection of the public drainage systems that are under the jurisdiction of those authorities have to be inspected once every 5 years. And then the last sections 10 and 11 are again conforming changes, replacing grass with the term perennial vegetation. And that's basically a quick run through of the policy provisions of the bill. Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Beard, you have a question.
I do have a couple of quick questions, Madam Chair, either for Representative Hansen or the testifier. The native vegetation you're talking about planting here, will that have to be replaced, or what's the program for replacing that? I can't imagine you're going to have it all plowed up and replanted in native vegetation if there's already good grass growing there now.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Beard, basically this law, the buffer strip requirements to the establishment of new grass or perennial vegetative buffer strips. So it's, if a ditch were to be new construction, okay, improved, or repaired, what's in place is not affected by this. And as far as native vegetation, the language that we have in the bill only requires the drainage authority to give preference to the use of native vegetation in that 16 and a half foot vegetative buffer strip.
thing. I had one more question, then, Madam Chair. Probably for Representative Hansen. In some other committees, Representative Hansen, that we've dealt with on issues of some of the new biofuels and biomass projects that are coming down the pike. In fact, I think you've got a cataloging bill we just passed through here a short while ago. One of the things that has been loosely discussed is using some of this, some native vegetation other than switchgrass or including switchgrass on property like this that can be mowed without impeding the water purification qualities of the grass. Under this law, if it were to pass, would that still be a possibility that we could actually harvest some of the autumn growth on that for biofuel use?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, the short answer is yes. Okay. The long answer is what we're doing here is amending a lot of drainage laws that have been around for 80 to 100 years. And so what we're doing is amending that. And so the provisions that already exist allow annual harvest of that one-rod buffer. What we're doing here is trying to establish some of that native grasses there so that you may have even a better opportunity for some of the cellulosic opportunity that we were talking about.
Yeah.
Also, the bill does provide for a continuation that the folks who have been working together that you see in the audience are going to continue working together, because we still have some interaction between the federal programs like CRP and these programs and how they interact in a county-by-county basis. And so the process of working on this bill, folks want to continue working on these things, and I think that this is a parallel track with the discussions we've been having relating to bioenergy.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I need a little help here because as I read Section 1, it sounds like we have a huge change in the drainage system right away. Right? Because as I read Section 1 under current law, it sounds like this strip that we're talking about that has the permanent grass is either as wide as the ditch from one end to the other or 16 and a half feet, whichever is greater. But under the new proposed law, doesn't matter how wide the ditch is, you are measuring at the top of the ditch in either direction 16 and a half feet. So, under current law, the drainage right-of-way can be up to 16 and a half feet if you say you got an 8-foot ditch, 8-foot wide ditch. Under your proposed law, that right-of-way goes from 16 and a half feet to 41 feet. Now, I have a lot of friends who, believe it or not, in Scott County, we still have a farm or two sitting there. And I know they don't farm right up on top of the ditch, but I know they're not sitting back 16 and a half feet. All right? And so I guess I need help in understanding this new drainage right-of-way that is created in Section 1.
Representative Hansen?
Madam Chair, I'll have Mr. Thomas answer that. Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the requirement for the 16 and a half foot buffer strip, and I'll just use the word buffer strip, dates back to 1977. It's been in place since then. If you read the language, starting on line 7, where it talks about the drainage authority shall, and that's again, this is existing language. It says they shall order that permanent grass, other than an ox sweep, be planted on the ditch side slopes. And previously that was referred to as a bank. Ditch side slope bank are basically the same thing. And it said on a strip, which is the deleted language. And then if you go back down to the deleted language on the third line from the bottom, it says on each side of the top edge of the channel of the ditch. So the old law basically said if the ditch was 8 feet wide at the top from bank to bank, you went 16 and a half feet out either side of that for the grass buffer strip. That's what the law said prior to today. All we're doing in here is clarifying. One is that instead of saying grass, it's the permanent strip for perennial vegetation approved by the drainage authority, meaning they've got some discretion
They could plant grasses. They could plant native grasses and forbs. They could allow other types of perennial vegetation. And then it goes on to say that the strip shall be 16.5 feet measured outward from the top edge of the constructed channel. And that's a clarification to make it much easier for our ditch inspectors, our viewers, and those people responsible for going out there at the time that there's a preceding, which requires, this doesn't require it to go into every ditch today. It basically says for any ditch that's a new ditch, an improvement to a ditch, or a major repair, or a proceeding which results in the appointment of viewers, that's the point in time that it requires that the buffer strip to be put in place. But we're not making it any larger in terms of the width of that buffer strip than what already existed in statute today or prior today. All we're trying to do is help clarify where the point of beginning is, and then simply that the strip goes outward from that 16.5 feet.
Representative Biskin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I beg to differ. Maybe I need some help, maybe a visual, all right, to something, because as I read current lots, it's 16.5 feet in width or to the crown of the leveled spoil bank, whichever is greater,
yeah,
right, on each side of the top edge of the channel of the ditch. That's current law. All right. So it's either 16.5 feet top, all right, whichever is bigger, and I get that. But now under this new law, it looks like we are saying that the 16.5 feet in width has to be measured from the top edge of the constructed channel resulting from the proceeding. It seems rather logical to me what's happening here, and maybe, like I said, a visual would help.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins. I wish I had the report with me, but there we do have some graphics of this, and on the Bowser webpage there is the report that was provided to the legislature last year, which addresses some of these issues. We spent, and actually there's a picture here that the work group spent a great deal of time on this particular issue. If I go back to legislative history, clarifying the buffer width was what I introduced in the spring or the winter of 2005, and that resulted in the study. And the study resulted in a report that said that there was 72% compliance reported with the buffer strip requirement. And we also asked the local drainage authorities where they were measuring the 16.5 feet, and we found wide variation in their response. So what we spent the last year on was trying to work with folks, take them at their word, look at compliance, how can we make this clearer, how can we change this so we can get more buffers on the land. And that's what the 1977 law was looking at. How can we get more buffers on the land, working with the landowners, implement those, and making sure that there's compliance with clear law to make sure that folks know what they're doing to comply. And so that's what the whole effort has been that's resulted in this process, where we've had, again, many of the folks that are in the room, hours and hours, days and days, working on and coming to agreement that this is what will help do that and help us in this overall effort. So it is very technical. It's very complex. There are terms in the drainage law that have one thing in meaning in drainage law and one meaning in the rest of the world, but it's a very complex statute, and I'm asking you to take the word of those folks who signed the letter that spent a great deal of time on this, look at the report, and if Mr. Thomas has anything else to say, I just ask for your consideration.
All right. Do you have a question? Representative Conan.
Yes, and this is for either one of you. If this is enacted, does this apply to any drainage system work that requires viewer from that day forward, or does this go back to 1977, or does this include any drainage system, no matter when it was constructed?
All right, Mr. Thomas.
Madam Chair, Representative, it basically is it's a new provision that would be required from this point on, so it would be any proceeding after the bill is enacted, which would require then the appointment of viewers which would be a new ditch, improved ditch, major repair proceeding.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 577 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to Environment and Natural Resource Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 457, Representative Gardner. I would move that House File 457 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Gardner, go ahead.
Good evening. Chair Hillstrom, I do have an author's amendment. The A7107 amendment.
All right. I would move amendment A07-107 to get the bill in the order the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Go ahead, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Chair Hillstrom. I thought it might be useful to walk through this bill, first describe the problem we're trying to address, then walk through the bill, and in each component I can mention where the amendment changes something in the original engrossment. Would that work for you?
All right, go ahead.
Very good. Madam Chair, I worked for 9 years in the recycling industry, the municipal recycling industry, which deals with cans, bottles, paper, and so on. But it was clear over the past few years that we've had an increasing problem because of the rising global demand for metals, in particular things like copper and aluminum. What we've seen in the last few years is an increasing amount of thefts nationwide from construction sites, abandoned homes, utilities, telecommunications infrastructure, and the like, where thieves are getting more and more organized, and they are stealing copper in particular, but other types of metals as well. Most of these metals are taken to scrap metal recyclers for cash, and this is a problem compounded by the fact that pseudoephedrine is no longer available over the counter, and so it's we're seeing few people cook their own meth in laboratories. And in an informal survey I had of counties last week at the PCA Waste Conference, they told me the number of meth labs has actually been going down. But now people are actually buying it, not off the shelf, but illicitly in other fashions through cash purchases. That's not the only source of the problem, but it's compounded the problem. Telecommunications companies, utilities, cities and counties, police and fire departments have all been, and builders associations have all been concerned about the continuing and rising economic losses from the theft of this material. There are some issues that are beyond our control, which is the global demand for this kind of material, which is really the fundamental source of the problem. However, most of these folks who are stealing the metals are taking it to scrap metal recyclers. And this bill is meant to increase record-keeping requirements on scrap metal recyclers and also to provide some tools for local law enforcement to be able to combat the problem and spot the people who are stealing the material. In addition to economic losses, we're also seeing an acute public safety problem. Four houses in the city of Minneapolis have actually exploded because their gas lines were cut because of people using power tools on gas lines. We've also discovered that four thieves have actually been electrocuted to death in the Upper Midwest, which is it's not the most savory picture you'd like to see. I won't pass those around. In any case, let me walk through the bill to demonstrate where we're going with this, and I'm sure there are people pro and con who would like to testify who will make this an interesting discussion, to say the least. First, the first part of the bill requires sellers of scrap metal to provide contact information. This can be in the form of driver's license number or other government identification. Would also include recording of driver's license license plate information. The amendment includes some changes to recognize that not everybody has a driver's license, and that sometimes people walk in on foot or even bike to scrap metal recyclers. This bill actually replaces a statute that was last changed in 1907. And so there's some language there that says lists must be kept in ink or typewriting. And so that the amendment gets rid of that and talks about having materials in writing. There are two possibilities for how scrap metal recyclers might transmit information about sellers to assist them in finding metal thieves and stolen property. One is through a through written records, which could be shown to police. The other one is through electronic reporting. So you do have the option as a scrap metal recycler of using something like the city of Minneapolis has, which is the automated pond system. The automated pond system is used in 175 different locations in Minnesota and Wisconsin and has been a way to increase recoveries of stolen property. And if you have questions on that, I think we may have someone from Minneapolis who might be able to answer some technical questions, maybe. Representative Holberg raised some valid concerns about data practices in the Public Safety Committee, and I actually have delayed this bill for about a month to answer that and several other concerns that people raised in the original hearing of this bill in Public Safety. Specifically, the amendment would prohibit the disclosure of personal information that's compiled by the scrap metal recyclers so that that would not be able to be sold or transferred other than to people seeking information for crime-solving purposes. The major part that you'll probably hear some opposition to from some of the testifiers would be on these so-called tag and hold provisions, the holding provisions. If you submit information in writing, you'd be asked to hold the metals that we're considering for 10 days. If you submit data to the police electronically, it would be 5 days. We recognize that, there are people like the Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts who are bringing in their old aluminum cans, and that seems kind of like a silly idea to have them record information and so on. And so aluminum cans are specifically exempted from this bill, so that anybody bringing cans would not have to be subject to the tag and hold provision, so you don't have piles and piles of cans waiting around. Automobiles are also exempted, and those are a fairly bulky item. Yes?
Representative Gardner, I may shorten you up here, because really the main reason why it is this bill has come to this committee is Subdivision 8 of the local regulation.
You'd like to cut right to the local government.
I think that the members of this committee would appreciate it very much if we cut right to the local regulation.
I just wanted to make sure people knew that I had listened to their concerns in public safety and had incorporated those in the amendment.
Okay.
But I was just the Subdivision 8 just asks or gives the ability for local government to require registration of scrap metal recyclers.
All right. Representative Holberg. I was on a roll here.
That was an honor. That's okay.
Sorry.
You can call me anything you want. Just don't call me late for supper.
All right. Representative Holberg.
Well, I first of all want to thank Representative Gardner for bringing this issue to us, because indeed it is an issue, I think, that's growing and also has some potential for, as you stated, some public safety that is extremely important. But one thing I like about the bill is that we know that scrap metal dealers throughout the state will have the same kind of regulation. But then in Subdivision 8, it would be that a scrap metal dealer some other place may have more stringent regulations. And I guess I think if I was a scrap metal dealer, I'd want to be able to say this regulation is no matter where you happen to locate. So I would like to just orally delete Subdivision 8, which is on page 4, lines 25 through 27. I think as we go through, we'll have a uniform action on it. Okay. And I visited with Representative Gardner on that. He's not surprised by it.
Okay. Representative Gardner, comments? This is the only reason, the only real reason why this bill is before this committee. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I talked briefly about an hour or so ago with Representative Solberg about this. I'm not wedded to this particular session. I know that there are some folks in law enforcement who would prefer a more rigorous version of this to require local cities to register, but I also recognize the needs in rural communities that when you have part-time staff, the licensing portion of that may be excessively burdensome. Senator Higgins has a much more vigorous section on this in the Senate, so we may see some discussion in local government and Senate, but I would be fine with Representative Solberg's amendment.
All right. Mm. Comments or questions from members? All right. All those in favor of deleting Subdivision 8, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gardner, this bill then really doesn't need to be in this committee's jurisdiction, but there have been a number of people who have waited here the entire time that we've been meeting. So I would like to give them just a few minutes to address their issues before the committee. Might help you get ready for the next one if members would just bear with me for a few minutes, because people have waited for a long time.
I'll take your lead, Ms. Manager.
All right. So if anyone would like to come forward and testify for or against this bill, I would appreciate it. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinert. I'm here tonight representing the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, better known as ISRI, for those of you who have been around here for a while. ISRI has numerous concerns with this legislation, including the one that was just removed from the legislation. But I can just enumerate just a few things that we have concerns with right off the top. Number one is the automated pond system, which is contained in the bill. The automated pond system, for those of you who don't know, was created a little over 10 years ago to work with the pond industry in Minnesota to help law enforcement officials identify items that came into pawn shops. Now, there's a big difference, I think all of us know, between a Sony television, a set of Callaway golf clubs, and a piece of copper tubing, of which we have a piece with us. It's an item that is unidentifiable. You can't distinguish it between from one customer or another that brings in the items. And in the end, law enforcement officials really can't piece that together as evidence. It's of very, very little utility. Second, as it relates to the automated pawn system, I think there's a lot of questions regarding its utility, whether or not it's been a help to law enforcement community, the law enforcement community in bringing about convictions, whether it's in this industry or the pawn industry. Third, regarding the automated pawn system, I think that you have to ask yourself whether or not the data in the automated pawn system is protected appropriately, like we protect public data in Chapter 13A of Minnesota statutes. That being, the automated pawn system is somewhat of an open system. Entities like law enforcement and local communities in Wisconsin have access to it. Private entities have access to it, like United Parcel Service, UPS, Abbott Northwestern Hospitals, the University of St. Thomas. They also have access to the automated pawn system. My other issue, big issue for this industry, is the tag and hold provision, which requires you to tag and hold merchandise metal that you purchase from customers for 5 days if it's registered under the automated pawn system, or 10 years if you fill out a written tag. The scrap metal industry is a commodities-based industry. If I purchase as a scrap dealer metal today, I pay my customers today's price. I can't wait 10 days to hold that metal and get paid what the market's going to bear a week and a half from now. So that provision is a killer for this industry. Number one, it's a killer because of the transaction, the business transaction that they enter into. And number two, the amount of materials that they have to hold within their yard for 10 days, it's just not workable. They bring metal in, they ship metal out. That's their business. Finally, Madam Chair, I think I would like to point out one other issue in terms of the surveillance issue. First and foremost, this industry has practices and procedures in place to deter criminals from coming to their yards. They've had these in place for quite some time now. They follow it on a national level through their national organization. They recognized this problem long ago. They also work very closely with law enforcement officials to try and identify metal theft crimes and to work together via whether it's email or faxes, so the law enforcement community and scrap yards are working together. It's working. I think you've seen in the newspapers with the statues in Minneapolis and Theodore Worth Park where they communicated together, they identified a crime, and they picked the guys up. The system works. I think with some simple regulation in terms of registration and possibly requiring the industry to collect certain information and hold it on their customers, law enforcement officials have always been, and they always will be, welcome to come in and pull those tags and identify people that they think have created a metal crime. With that, Madam Chair, if you would indulge a couple of my clients for a few minutes to answer questions and to provide some comments, I'd appreciate it. Thank you again.
All right. Questions or comments from members? Okay, if you'd like to come to the table quickly, and you've waited a long time, and we want to, you know, recognize that that you have some concerns, and I hope that you'll continue your discussions as you move to the next committee. Go ahead, state your name for the record. Go ahead and pull a chair up from the table, and then you'll be ready to go right away.
My name is Mark Leader. I have a scrap metal recycling facility, and we've been in business in the state of Minnesota for 94 years. I'm also the vice president of the local chapter of ISRI, the national organization that is a trade organization for the scrap recycling industry. I'd like to tell you that the scrap recycling industry here, Madam Chair, in our state conservatively is a $1 billion industry. Those funds stay in our state. The local person as well as the industry captain has their metallic waste that they can resell and get some value for them. We contribute to the state in more ways than most companies. We bring jobs, a tax base, and a variety of job classes for all levels of skills. We keep the state clean. We restore our state. We don't deplete it. The state claims that it has shown performance to be one of the more involved states in its goals to recycle. This is what we do 100% of the time. The state programs and its efforts to recycle are small in comparison to what we do privately without state subsidies. This quiet private industry has done this for more than 150 years here in Minnesota. We in the industry have already started a program on our own in an effort to curtail the criminal acts. We have a national organization, ISRI, that is willing to work countrywide and with all the individual states. Here in Minnesota, our local chapter has an understanding of the problem, and we would be very willing to team with lawmakers in order to produce a workable solution. I don't know how many of you gathered here have ever been in a scrap recycling facility, and I don't think there's too many of you that have. And I don't know if it's proper etiquette, Madam Chair, to ask, but I would say that it's unwise to create a bad law when many of those who participate in making laws may be unfamiliar with our industry, its products, and the unique commodity market structures of recyclables. Recycling and pawn shops are not and should not be considered similar industries to regulate. There's a tremendous difference between pawnbrokers and metal recyclers. Many of the items accepted by pawnbrokers are small and readily identifiable. In contrast, most of the metal brought to a scrapyard is not marked or identifiable. It can be quite bulky. We have some examples here that we'd be happy to show you. Another difference is that a scrap dealer or processor like myself is the first link in a large manufacturing chain providing a raw material, what we call scrap, to a manufacturer for creation of a finished product. This chain begins and ends with the scrap processor and encourages recycling, responsible environmental management, and a reduction of materials destined to our community's overburdened landfills. Scrap processors have invested thousands and sometimes millions of dollars in equipment that specialize in sorting, shredding, shearing, cutting, and chopping up scrap metals. All this is an effort to prepare the material for sale to a manufacturer. A pawnbroker does not have this intensive capital investment in equipment, and he can operate out of a storefront. Okay. We are a dynamic manufacturing process.
Excuse me, if I could get you to wrap up in just a very short period of time.
Okay. This will be 30 seconds. Minnesota companies must be able to buy and sell scrap like all other competitors in the global market for scrap. We cannot be saddled with a hold time on materials. This is a commodity market we participate in, and we cannot be at a disadvantage in live markets. We cannot be at a disadvantage to our neighbor states. This state does not want to lose recycling participation or the jobs and the tax bases that the private recyclers contribute to our state. I thank Madam Chair and the gathered representatives for this time.
All right, thank you.
And my colleague Andy.
All right. If you could just comment on whatever's new that we haven't already heard.
Okay.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Andy Stabell. I'm the president of Great Western Recycling here in St. Paul. I'm just going to point out a couple of quick illustrations. One is, this is 1 month's transactions of individual commodities from individual persons. There are 16,000 transactions in this particular month. And for us to individualize those, hold them for a period of 5 days or 10 days, is physically a challenge beyond, you know, my comprehension and how we would do that. And so I want to point that out. One other thing, in a previous hearing, they talked about 400 houses that have been are abandoned or abandoned properties or whatever in the city of St. Paul. 25% of those houses have been pilfered from, metal removed from them. 100 pounds a piece in each house was theorized as far as what metal was recovered from them. That's 10,000 pounds. Our one business, which is one metal recycler in St. Paul, recycled 3.5 million pounds over the course of a year. And these houses have 10,000 pounds missing. This is a needle in a haystack, and it's a big challenge, and we're going to try to figure out a way to come up with a solution that will support the law enforcement community. But it's only by working together that we'll be able to do that. So.
Thank you very much, and Representative Gardner, thank you for bringing the bill and agreeing to continue to work with members.
You bet. I'm going to visit Great Western on Friday. All We've right. had to miss it because of weather and so on.
All right. With that, I would renew my motion. Oh, sorry, somebody else. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. State your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Sergeant Paul Ford. I'm an investigator with the St. Paul Police Department, and I investigate these crimes. Like the last speaker just said, this is a needle in a haystack, but I don't know if any of you own rental property or if you own lake cabins. I don't think it would be an enjoyable experience to go to your lake cabin or your vacant rental property and find all the coppers missing. Like I said, I investigate these crimes. By the time we get this case, usually the copper, the evidence, or this precious metal is gone, and the suspects are gone. I have made attempts in several cases to contact various scrap yards, and their records are sparse at best. I can highlight this by one of the investigators in our office. He took a ladder that we had that was damaged. It had St. Paul Police property, a sticker on it. We had it cut up. He brought it to a scrap yard. They bought it. Another instance, we had acquired some copper. It was cut up and packaged in a manner similar to copper when we have recovered it. He brought it to a local scrap yard. They asked for ID. He said he didn't have any. And then they said they wouldn't take it, and he offered to sell it for half of the current market value. At that point, they took it. This was all videotaped, and it was on KSTP News. And I don't know if the representative has a copy of that video.
I do have it. I didn't really want to inflame the whole situation here, but... I will say that those scrap recyclers are not represented here, that I can tell. So, in a sense of fairness, I won't show it. But you can look at it at the KSTP website.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
And just to wrap it up, this is a huge issue for us. And it's not only a public safety issue, but, you know, other businesses, electrical contractors, construction companies, we're all affected by it. I can understand the industry's concern about having to tag and hold their property for an extended period of time. And, myself, and I'm sure the representative here, as well as Senator Linda Higgins, would be more than willing to work with the industry on an alternative to that. But as of now, there's no regulation, and something does need to change. Thank you. I'll sit for questions.
Thanks so much. All right. Did you have something to add? Okay. Great. All right. Are there more? Okay. Please be brief, because the part of this bill that was involved in this committee has been deleted, and so.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Go ahead. State your name.
Mary Pedersen from the City of Minneapolis. I work for the automated pawn system. That's my job. So I just felt I had to say something. We're not comparing pawn shops to scrap metal dealers whatsoever. Although in pretty much every city in the country, if you look at their ordinances, you'll find scrap metal, secondhand, and pawnbroker ordinances are lumped in together, and they're one ordinance, or perhaps two, secondhand goods and scrap or junk dealers. Our system just happens to be a computerized electronic record-keeping database that could and is being adapted to take scrap metal transactions, providing the uniformity that law enforcement needs to search records for people, vehicles, and products. So that's our only claim, is that it would be a tool and a means for anybody in law enforcement to actually see this data real time. You know, having a record in a book sitting someplace 150 miles away from you or 25 miles away from you isn't really going to do you any good if you're trying to identify your product or people. Driving to all those locations, or even having paper delivered to you that somebody has to sort through and type into an access to the database or an Excel spreadsheet, would make you know, this job very difficult at best.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay.
I will be very quick.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Dustin Gibbs. I am a partial owner of two scrap yards in north of downtown Minneapolis. Our scrap yards, between the two, have 600 transactions per day. Those 600 transactions, within each transaction, there's probably four types of material. So that means 2,400 types of material are purchased each day. In a week, that's 13,200 individual items purchased. In a year, that's 686,000 types of material purchased. We take pictures of every piece of material that is purchased. We also take pictures of the people that are bringing in the material and receiving the cash for that material. We have 858,000 pictures of material and people that bring scrap into our facilities. We spend $70 million a year, which goes into the hands of Minnesotans. If the tag and hold portion of this bill comes into effect, it will bring us to our knees. We will be able to last probably 35 minutes. We have fantastic record keeping, which is available to the police department of any level in the state of Minnesota. As an example, in the tag and hold situation, early in December, we contacted the Minneapolis Police Department because a specific firm contacted us by fax stating that they had lost some material. This material was recognized by our buyer as it was brought in. We took the person's identification. We kept the material. We took the picture of the person at our cash machine. We called the company. We said, we believe we have your material. Not only was this copper stolen from the firm, also $6,000 worth of tools were stolen. We contacted the Minneapolis Police Department, and believe me, I'm not being critical in any way, shape, or form. They are very busy. They have an awful lot of things to do. We contacted the Minneapolis Police Department. They sent an investigator. All the information was given to them. IDs, pictures, material, everything was given to them. That was the first week in December. As of Thursday, nothing had been done. The tag and hold portion of this bill is not going to have any effect on the thefts. As far as the pictures of the people, as far as the identification, as far as whatever else you guys want to do, it's fine. The tag and hold portion will absolutely destroy our industry.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. With that, I would encourage you, Representative Gardner, to work with the concerns that are here. And I'm going to move that House File 457 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Thank you so much. We're going to take Representative Dominguez next, House File 1045.
Sorry to clear out the room.
It's all right. Now, thanks for bearing with us, members. We'll try to wrap up as quickly as possible. All right, Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Your House File 1045 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation that it be re-referred to Environment and Natural Resources Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My House File 1045 is a request from the Metropolitan Council, and is a minor technical change to the Section 279A.94 to clarify distribution of lottery funds for the regional parks and council. Also, a change in the Statute 473.303 to provide per diem payment to the Met Parks and Open Space Commission members. Madam Chair, I have a testifier here. I'm going to turn it over to him because I know we're lacking on time. So,
All right. First, we need to act on the A1 amendment.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Dominguez moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order he would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, my name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I'd like to thank you and Representative Dominguez for hearing the bill. What I have before you is relatively simple. The first two sections I'm going to address, and I'll let Chairman Bell address the Parks Foundation piece. What we're doing is right now the council receives some of its parks operating money through the lottery and lieu statute. All we're doing is asking, or is going into that statute and stating that that the Metropolitan Parks system is part of the metropolitan area, the seven county metropolitan area, and we just needed to define that in that statute. So that's why we are here before you with that. Then the second piece is to allow the council to pay its members of the Parks and Open Space Commission per diem. That's basically it. And then the amendment, Chairman Bell is going to speak to real quickly the amendment that he just put on the bill.
Mr. Bell, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Setting up the Parks Foundation would authorize the Metropolitan Council to raise private dollars to set up an affiliated, though separately governed organization that would be authorized to raise private dollars for capital costs for the regional park system. It would also allow us to initially capitalize this effort with up to $500,000. We hope to get matching dollars from local foundations to do this. As you know, Madam Chair, the park system is 53,000 acres. Our park system plan calls for increasing that to 70,000 acres and going from 177 miles of trails to 877 miles of trails. Current bonding dollars, both from the state and from the Met Council, really won't get us from the current state of affairs that we are now in terms of land acquisition to where we aspire to be. And this effort would allow us to bring private dollars to bear.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Houseman.
Just to the amendment or to the bill?
We've adopted the amendment, so to the amendment or to the bill would be in order. Representative Houseman.
Madam Chair, Section 1. In other words, this is going to move from state oversight of the money to be directly given to the Met Council and dispersed there. Do we lose what state oversight we had, or
Mr. Bell?
Madam Chair, Representative Houseman, no, it would not. The dollars that are provided from bonding dollars would still have the same process of distribution that currently exists. These would be new additional dollars that would be used, that would be raised from private sources. So the current oversight that exists today for the current bonding dollars that are provided today would remain unchanged.
Madam Chair,
Representative Houseman,
maybe I'm not understanding this, but if I just look at the bill on page 2, lines 22 through 25, it looks as though in the past that would have been deposited in the Natural Resources Fund and spent on Metropolitan Parks and Trails, But this is adding language that specifically says spent in this way and dispersed by the Met Council. It feels as though that language moves us away from some of the role that the state has had and defines that very specifically the Metropolitan Council jurisdiction.
Ms. Lefevre, would you be able to help us with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Houseman, it's my understanding that this money is being spent for these programs now, that this is just clarifying by putting the statutory references to the program in.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Shetman.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Houseman. The bill as it sits right now, the House File 881, what we are doing, if you're looking at if you're talking about the lottery and lieu money, that money we currently receive as part of our O&M budget. If you're talking about the amendment that we just placed on the bill, the Parks Foundation, are you speaking to the bill?
Yeah.
Okay, that is money that we currently receive for parks operating and maintenance budget through the state. We get that through the lottery in lieu, and we also receive general fund money from the state. All we are doing, we're not changing how that money comes to us. We're just defining the seven-county metropolitan area, because currently the lottery in lieu language states that it goes to the metropolitan park system. We're just adding in there what the metropolitan park system, where that lies, and that's within the seven-county metropolitan area. It's a very technical, housekeeping, simple amendment. We're not changing how any of the money is spent or where it's coming from at all.
Clarification, Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, what then, why is the language dispersed by the Metropolitan Council necessary?
Mr. Shitton.
Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, I believe that that's dispersed by the Metropolitan Council through the implementing agencies, the 10 parks implementing agencies. We get that money and disperse that. Mr. Stefford's here, who is our parks expert, and he can speak to that more clearly, but there really isn't a significant change, but I'll let Mr. Stefford speak to that.
State your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Arnie Stefford. I'm a planning analyst in the Parks Program at the Metro Council. Minnesota Statutes 473.351 direct the council to disperse state funds for regional parks operations and maintenance. And the amendment to this bill deals with Minnesota Statute 279.894, which takes lottery in lieu of sales tax revenue and disperses it to the Metro Council for disbursement to these park agencies. We want to clarify that that money is to be used for the Metropolitan Regional Park System only, not for local parks in the metropolitan area. Minnesota Statute 279A.94 is broadly worded currently, and that's why the amendment is proposed. So it is very clear that it's to be used for Metro Regional Parks. That has been used that way since this law was enacted in 2000.
I could get a clarification. Does that mean that my local park that abuts my district, the Mississippi Regional Park, would no longer be eligible for this money?
Madam Chair, no. It's a regional park, Mississippi Regional Park. But if it was a neighborhood park, it's never received this money.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to get that clarification. Representative Biskin.
Well, so then for further clarification, Madam Chair, Lagoon Park in Jordan, under current law, would be eligible, but it's never been dispersed because that's just a community park, and you're trying to clean that up for clarification?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, that's correct. The law as written and enacted in 2000 was to be used for metro regional parks, and that's how the money has been dispersed and spent.
Further clarification, Representative Biskin?
Well, no, Madam Chair, but Lagoon Park is a nice park.
All right. Further clarification for members or questions?
Yep.
Okay. We do have a question. With the amendment, are you meaning for the effective date to be immediate as well, because you have an immediate effective date in the bill? Mr. Bell?
Madam Chair, yes, we are.
All right. All right. That's clear. Ms. Lefevre, is that clear in the language then?
It's not clear, but we can fix it.
Okay. All right. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, one other question on a serious note. Chairman Bell, the $50 per diem, is that going to be a line item budget out of the council's general fund, or will that come directly from the Parks and Open Spaces Fund? And in either case, how much do you anticipate that annual cost to be?
Mr. Bell.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, one point I want to make about this fee, and then I'll answer the question directly, is that this is a fee that we used to pay and that we are only reestablishing it, and I'm not sure what the dollar amount is. You know any?
Madam Chair? Yeah. Madam Chair, yes. And Representative Biskins, it's a $50 per diem proposal here. There are 9 members on the commission, so that'd be $450 per meeting, and they meet right now once a month, So 12 times $450. They may have special meetings in addition to that.
All right. Further questions? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew Representative Dominguez will renew his motion that House File 1045 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with recommendation that it be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resource Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dominguez, why don't you just stay right there? Not you, Willie, but I'm going to stay right here. I have the next two bills, House File 881. It's the Metropolitan Land Planning Act and related statutes modified and erroneous and obsolete references corrected. This is a Metropolitan Council agency bill, and so they can do the work here. So go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And Madam Chair, I believe we may have an author's amendment.
Yes, like I would move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, this is to put the bill in the manner in which the author would like it. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right. Mr. Shetland, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 881 is a Land Planning Act housekeeping bill that the council is presenting before you today. What this bill does is just very simple. We're proposing no real substantive policy changes to the Land Planning Act. All that we're trying to do is to repeal some sections of law that are obsolete.
I need to interrupt you for just a moment because I never moved the bill.
Oh.
I move that House File 881 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All right, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're trying to substitute some statutory citations for old session law references and clean up sections of the Land Planning Act that have either been amended or repealed. We think that this amendment is good for both the council and the local governments. We've worked with the folks at AMM and Mr. Jamboy, and we believe that we have a bill before you that is technical in nature. It is housekeeping, and if there are any questions, I've got Guy Peterson with me, who runs our community development program for the Metropolitan Council, and I know that Mr. Jamboy is here who can speak to the fact that we are all in agreement on this bill.
All right. Questions from members? Oh, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Point of order, since we adopted the amendment before you moved the bill, you might want to do that again.
All right. Well, I would remove the A1 amendment to put it in the order in which the author chooses. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right. Is there anyone in the audience? Oh, do you have a question, Representative Biskins? Yes. Representative Biskins.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Shetland, would you please explain why we would delete the ability of local units of government to request a hearing, as it appears this piece of legislation is doing on page 2, lines 29 and beyond?
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, I'd be happy to do that. I'm going to allow Mr. Peterson to do that, however.
Mr. Peterson, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, we've looked back, and as far as we can tell, there's been no time that we can find when a community has requested a hearing with regard to this section of the law. And other than providing for a forum for discussion that a hearing might provide, unless it has to do with a systems-related issue, would only be advisory comments. We cannot mandate that a community change its comprehensive plan if another community were to ask for a hearing about that comprehensive plan. And if it were systems related, the law does provide two other places in the statute for communities to request a hearing, one of which is with regard to the systems process. So typically we worked out the problems with communities through meetings and negotiations, and hearings have not been called for.
Right. Further
follow-up,
Representative Biskin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, but I wonder if, though, eliminating this section wouldn't then create more contention. Right now, it seems that parties, by your own testimony, work things out prior to a formal hearing. And I wonder if, you know, that isn't because there is ultimately that formal hearing possibility. And now eliminating that possibility creates a more contentious situation than not. I just wonder what the harm is for having this here, right, and why we'd want to eliminate it. Simply because it doesn't get used, or maybe it hasn't formally gotten used, but maybe informally in the dialogue and the back and forth, it could very well have been used.
Mr. Shetland.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Biskins. As Mr. Peterson's mentioned, this has never been a formal request. What I'd like to do is have Mr. Jamboy come up from AMM and speak to how the cities feel about this. We were in agreement that this was not an issue, but if you'd feel better hearing from the folks who represent the cities and why they were okay with it, I think that might help.
All right, Mr. Jamboy, please come to the table and be brief. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy, and to be brief, we support this amendment. We think it's housekeeping. We think there's plenty of other opportunities within the statute for cities to get involved in responding to the council and to each other. And we concurred with the council's contention that this was an unnecessary provision in the statute.
All right. Further questions? All right. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, I would renew my motion that House File 881 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, next is House File 882, also mine, which is a department bill. And this will be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Great. And thank you.
State your name for the record. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate you carrying the bill for us, and I appreciate the committee taking the time to consider it today. I will be brief. I understand last Monday evening this bill was moved in front of the committee and an amendment was placed on there. It was an author's amendment, I understand. I apologize. I was over in the Senate last Monday night. I just want to make sure that amendment was placed on the bill.
Why don't I move the A1 amendment?
Great.
This is the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. What this bill does is two things. It takes $1 million from our Livable Communities Demonstration account and allows the council to take that money and set up a grant program for cities. As you know, the next round of comp plan amendments, our comp plan updates are due in 2008, and what the council is seeking is to use $1 million of those Livable Communities Demonstration Account dollars to help out some of the smaller cities who don't have the staff to put together their comp plans. We're trying to work with the cities to help them out in that way. I know we explained this when we presented in your committee prior to that, so I'll jump to the next piece. I know we also mentioned this before. We're looking for flexibility to transfer up to $3 million from the Livable Communities Demonstration Account to the Tax-Based Revitalization Account, or vice versa. We have spoke to our friends at AMM as well. I know that Mr. Jamboy would like to speak to this. I know also that Representative Lincheski has some questions about this, and we appreciate the opportunity to hopefully come see her and sit down and talk about this when it makes its way to the Tax Committee.
Let me make it real clear that I hope that you will be working with the tax chair.
Yep.
Make certain that the tax implications that we don't really have jurisdiction over in this committee will be addressed. We'll be talking about the policy pieces in this committee. So, with that, questions from members? Representative Biskin?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I'll just reiterate the concerns that I had previous when this was before us last time. Members, I think of this committee, what we're looking at is creating a system, or allowing for the creation of a system, where you have a pot of money that was given authorization to be collected for one purpose from a group of taxpayers, and another pot, which was directed by the legislature to be raised from a different set of taxpayers for a different purpose, to be intermingled now. Right. Where is the principle behind that? I guess I don't get that. You know, and I've had the opportunity to speak with members of the Met Council, and to me, it would seem reasonable, right, to do one of two things, right? Either change the criteria for which the allowable uses from each of these pots can then be intermingled. Right? That would be intellectually honest to the taxpayers in which the money was derived from, or to, if one area needs more money and another less, which is that shifting, then raise the levy from the one pot and correspondingly reduce the levy in the other. That again seems intellectually honest. But when you have two pots of money collected for very different purposes from different taxpayers, and you're going to now, over the top, let the intermingling occur, I don't think we're being real honest with the taxpayers in which the money is collected.
All right. Further questions? Given the controversy of the issue, potentially we should move that this be sent to taxes without recommendation, because I think that there's going to need to be some discussion about this piece. Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Biskins. I had the opportunity to speak with Representative Biskins earlier, and I think that he makes some decent points, and we'd be happy to continue this discussion. I'm happy with the no further recommendation, and like I mentioned, we will make sure that we spend some time on this bill. I appreciate your support.
That would be great. Representative Lincheski, any thoughts or comments? Or? All right. With that, I will... is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none. Someone's coming. Mr. Jamboy. Got to get up a little faster. I didn't see you.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm not as quick as I once was. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, Metro Cities. Our sole purpose for being here today and addressing you on this issue is that we think the LCDA, the Livable Communities Demonstration Grant Program, has been a very successful program. The purpose for working together with the Met Council to move money around and vice from LCDA to tax-based revitalization program and back, notwithstanding the very valid comments that we've heard today, was to take the target off the back of the LCDA program. We think it's been run very well. The Met Council members themselves have had some heartburn about it, and we think it's been run well. We didn't want to see the levy cut. It was cut in December. We opposed that. We saw this as another erosion of the tax-based revitalization program, and we thought if one program's being analyzed, both should, and if money's taken out of one program and moved to another, it should be done based on program criteria and not whimsy. And that was our purpose for getting together with the Met Council on this issue. But we look forward to the tax committee hearing as well.
All right, further discussion of members. All right, hearing and seeing none, I would move that House File 882 be passed on to the tax committee without recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. Thank you. All right, the last bill on the agenda, we have 12 minutes.
Aye.
Please come to the table. Representative Lanning moves that House File 1429 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Erdahl, while you get seated, I'm going to also have someone move the minutes to approve the minutes of Wednesday, February 28th. Representative Hausman moves the minutes of February 28th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. All right. Representative Erdahl, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the timeliness. You told me to be ready at 6:45, and we're right about there. This is just another simple Erdahl consent calendar type bill. And it's from the Meeker County Economic Development Authority. As I understand it, the Meeker County EDA was authorized in 1998 under a special law. County EDAs were not authorized by Minnesota statute until 2000. An authority for nine member boards was added in 2005. Because the Meeker County EDA operates under a special law that does not refer to the statute that allows for nine member boards, they need special authorization and special legislation. What they would like to do is add the cities of Grove City and Litchfield, which are currently represented by county commissioners. This would leave the county commissioners representing the county and not specific cities. So there it is.
All right, questions? All right, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lanning renews his motion that House File 1429 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. And with that, members, we
Thank
are
you.
Adjourned.